From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. New political polls are out today. They show Senator Obama expanding his lead.
Analysts say it's the economic meltdown and will begin there today. The Senate votes tonight on a new version of the federal bailout package.
The key feature, raise the limit of government guarantees for bank deposits, the FDIC, from $100,000 to $250,000.
Michael Mandel is a chief economist for Business Week. He cheered when the House voted down the first bailout package just 2 days ago. What about now?
Today's plan is somewhat better. It includes an expansion of deposit insurance. I'm still not happy about the rest of the plan. Frankly, I think the first thing they should do is expand deposit insurance. That's something that will get bipartisan support, and it will have the effect of firming up the most important part of the financial system, which is the banks.
The banks. It's going to help the banks. You write you're concerned that the original bailout plan would have helped foreign lenders more than it would have helped ordinary Americans, I guess. I'm not quite sure I follow what you're saying there.
Well, what's happening right now is that the U.S. borrowed an immense amount of money from overseas over the last few years, roughly about $3 trillion. From my view, this crisis is about foreign investors realizing that a lot of those loans may go bad. What the bailout plan would do by buying up the bad debt is basically prop up those prices and help the foreign investors. But it wouldn't do anything directly for American borrowers. So from my point of view, this plan, you know, the populist reaction to it was right on point. It didn't do anything to address the deep underlying problems.
But isn't the idea of putting more money into the system meant to directly address this credit crisis that so many people are talking about?
It matters where you put the money in. Okay, what we've got now is a leaky boat filling with water. What the bailout plan does is it bails out the boat, but doesn't fix the hole in the bottom of it. What I worry about is, putting in $700 billion will help in the short run, but it won't actually do anything to deal with the big problem, which is going to be divvying up the losses on the debt. Divvying it up. You know, what we have to do now, we know that there are losses out there. We know that part of that $3 trillion that the U.S. owes to the rest of the world is not going to get paid back. And the question now is, who really is going to have to bear the loss? Is it going to be the borrowers? Is it going to be U.S. taxpayers? Or are foreign investors going to have to take part of the hit? The best outcome is shared sacrifice. The bailout plan doesn't do that.
You are about to publish a textbook. The title is Economics, the Basics. So let me ask you about something that crossed on the news wires today. A measure of U.S. manufacturing activity contracted more than expected in September as new orders slowed dramatically. New orders for big manufactured goods. The expectation of this was that you'd have a score of 49.5. The actual score is 43.5. That's a huge difference, it seems to me.
We are definitely slipping into a recession at this point. There is no doubt about it. It's going to be quite a nasty one. I don't think, though, that's really the issue at this point. The real issue right now is, can you keep the financial system intact? Because if you can keep the financial system intact, then the U.S. economy will come out of this recession and will actually come out of it stronger than it is now. So that's really your question. What bailout plan, what rescue plan do you do that is actually has the chance of fixing the real problems?
If you were a member of Congress, you would have voted no on Monday.
I would have voted no on Monday.
If you were a member of the U.S. Senate, would you vote yes tonight?
What I would do is I would vote to sever the bailout package from the deposit insurance package. I'd vote the deposit insurance package immediately. And then I would send Paulson and Bernanke back again. Say, give me a real plan this time. Don't give me something that throws in a lot of money that's just going to get burnt up. Because really, we only have one chance to do this right, and the plan that they had was not the right plan.
Mike Mandel, chief economist at Business Week. Mike, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Banks have been collapsing or disappearing into other banks at a rapid pace, and we now have a few enormous banks. Is that good or bad for consumers? Here to answer that question is Jean Ann Fox. She's Director of Financial Services at the Consumer Federation of America. And Ms. Fox, what does all this mean, this consolidation, for the average depositor?
Well, it means that the bank you've been used to doing business with may no longer exist, and competition for banking services may be reduced. The impact on a particular product or service depends on which banks have merged and what products the disappearing bank offered, but it is a good time for consumers to pay close attention to their bank accounts.
So what should they be looking for?
Well, first of all, they need to be sure they don't have more money in one particular bank than the FDIC insurance covers. You know, basically that's $100,000 in an individual account. But beyond that, we need to pay attention to changes that can take place in bank accounts as banks adjust to the market, because under the account agreements that we sign when we open our checking accounts, generally the banks reserve the right to make any change as long as they give you some form of notice about it. So we have to pay attention to the boring fine print that comes in the bank account statement or notices that are posted on our online bank accounts.
In general, looking at recent history, is it better or worse to be with a gigantic bank?
Generally, you get a better deal with smaller community banks or credit unions on fees. A few years ago, CFA did a report on the biggest banks' overdraft and bounce check fees, and in 2005, the largest 10 banks were charging a little over $30 each time they let a customer overdraw their bank account. That fee this year has gone up to an average of $34.65. So that's over a $4 jump in just 3 years in that one fee. Generally, the largest banks charge the highest fees.
What kind of fees are we seeing now besides the overdraft protection fees?
Well, banks also charge if they reject a transaction that overdraws your account. We call that a bounce check fee. They charge if you use an ATM when you're not one of their customers. They charge if you deposit something that turns out to bounce, getting an extra bank statement, all the other services that you might ask for. It's hard for consumers to get that information when they're out shopping for a bank account, although the Truth in Savings Act requires that banks make account information available to consumers. Studies by the Government Accountability Office and others have indicated that it's sometimes hard to get your hands on detailed information before you open a checking account.
With these fewer banks and bigger banks, does that mean less competition, and does less competition mean a worse deal for consumers?
Well, definitely there will be fewer of the very largest banks, but there's still thousands of community banks and credit unions around the country. Anytime there's a big change in the banking industry, it's a good time for consumers to go reshop the market and see if you can get a better deal at lower cost at a smaller bank. Just because we've got these great big banks with their huge ATM networks doesn't necessarily mean they're the best deal for everybody.
Jean Ann Fox is Director of Financial Services at the Consumer Federation of America. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Trends in political polling. We're joined by NPR's Ken Rudin, political editor. Ken, welcome back to Day to Day. And several polls are showing numbers moving toward Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think, Alex, it started with the debate. I think it also started with the economic downturn and the worries on Wall Street. When it comes to the economy, you have to remember that the last 8 years, it's been George Bush in the White House. It's been the Republicans in control. And it looks like the polls are accurate, John McCain is paying for it.
Let's talk about a couple of different poll numbers, national poll numbers and then state numbers. We'll begin with national. The Pew Center for Research says that Senator Obama now has a clear and significant lead over Senator McCain, 49% to 42% national numbers. The first time that Pew has found this since June.
Right. That's good news for Obama. Of course, other national polls, other national surveys have also shown Obama, if not pulling away, certainly with a lead of 4, 5, 6 points. Again, when the focus is on the economy, and as James Carville said, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And Alex, you don't mind if I call you stupid, do you? Because I've done that before. But with the economy, the focus, it takes away the strength of John McCain. John McCain has admitted over and over again that he is not an expert on economic matters, and it indicates that in the polls. But Even though it's a national survey, remember this is not a national election. It's 51 separate elections, 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And in those states, you also see an Obama lead starting to open up.
Well, that's it. There are these so-called battleground states or swing states, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Florida, Colorado. I've been following these states in polls at the site called Real Clear Politics. And over the last 10 days, you see every day a little bit, you know, 0.2, 0.3. These states moving more towards Senator Obama.
Exactly. And the key, of course, is 270 electoral votes. And with 5 weeks to go, less than 5 weeks to go, it seems to be moving in Barack Obama's direction. But in a state like Ohio, no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. In the latest Quinnipiac poll, Obama has opened up a sizable lead. In Florida, where John McCain had been leading for the longest time, Barack Obama seems to have opened up a 4, 5, 6 point lead. And in Pennsylvania, the other state that Quinnipiac has polled, McCain has worked very hard to win over blue-collar whites. Sounds like I'm doing laundry here. But blue-collar white voters, things like that. And yet Obama seems to be keeping Pennsylvania in the Democratic column. It's hard to see what blue states that John Kerry and Al Gore won in 2004, 2000, that McCain could pry away from Obama at this point anyway.
There's another piece at Politico.com today saying that several Republican state chairmen are getting very anxious about this, and they're talking to the McCain campaign.
Well, I don't know what they can say. Obviously, Thursday night's debate, vice presidential debate, there will be a tremendous amount of attention on that. Sarah Palin, which once upon a time gave the Republican ticket a boost, now seems to be a drag on the Republican ticket. And again, you know, even you talk about different states where Republicans are nervous. In Indiana, which has gone Republican every election since 1964 when Lyndon Johnson won, Republicans are on the air in Indiana for the first time in at least a dozen years, which shows the kind of nervousness that they're under.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin with us from Washington. Ken, thank you.
Thank you, Alex, and I'm sorry I called you stupid.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. The vice presidential debate is tomorrow night. Day to Day has advice for both candidates. We'll begin with Byron York. He's White House correspondent for the National Review on Governor Palin. Byron, welcome to Day to Day. And you've got suggestions for the governor in a blog posting this week.
I think a number of observers were curious and perhaps a little surprised in the governor's two big rollout interviews with ABC and CBS that she did not speak more about her experience as governor of Alaska. You know, when you think about it, what does a governor do when he or she is running for president? They talk about what they did in Texas or what they accomplished in Arkansas. It's just what they do. It's not foreign policy experience, but it is solid domestic experience. And I think people have been a little surprised that she hasn't made greater use of that.
William Kristol at the New York Times and others suggest that the McCain campaign has sort of blown it by limiting her to a few interviews rather than having her out where she really would have to be interacting, taking a lot of questions. And the consequence is people now are watching for tomorrow night to see if it is the Sarah Palin train wreck.
Well, there's a couple of parts to that criticism, both of which I think are valid. One is, yes, she hasn't been out enough and thus gotten used to taking questions. The other is kind of the dinosaur strategy employed by the McCain campaign in the rollout, in which they relied on two big interviews, one with ABC, one with CBS, inexplicably CBS being the lowest rated of the broadcast networks. It's a media strategy that would be similar to rolling out a candidate in 1976. No use of conservative talk radio, the blogosphere, maybe selected use of local television, radio, newspapers in, you know, key states. There could have been a much broader media strategy that could have placed Palin, you know, in friendly context and also in very useful context. And instead, they went with the old broadcast networks, which is kind of baffling.
She was on a right-wing radio show based here in Los Angeles, the Hugh Hewitt Show, late yesterday. She was talking about Joe Sixpack. Maybe we'll hear more of that tomorrow night.
I would not be surprised, certainly after the debate, to see her diversifying a lot in the media that she does. I wouldn't be surprised to see her hear her on the top talk radio shows and to see her doing a lot more local media, which is really important. I mean, in all of these swing states, people are watching and reading their local press outlets, and I'd be surprised if they don't make greater use of that.
You just wonder about her anxiety level for tomorrow night. You must have gone on big platforms where you have to get up and perform. How do you actually get ready to do that?
Well, I think going on Meet the Press is not quite the same as a high wire act debate running for vice president. So I don't think I have similar experiences, but when she ran for governor in Alaska in 2006, performed extremely well. I've gone back and looked at the debates. I would encourage people to go back and look at the YouTube versions of the debates that are available. But, you know, when you're running for president and you've never run for president before, everything you've done prior to that is on a smaller scale. So she has done debates. They did involve a lot of pressure, but they're not as big as this one. So the question is, can she step up to this next level of pressure? And we won't know till we see what happens.
Byron York, White House correspondent for National Review. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Joe Biden, what should he do and how should he behave at tomorrow's debate? Dan Gerstein is a political communications consultant who worked on Senator Joe Lieberman's vice presidential campaign back in 2000. And Dan, what is Senator Biden's biggest problem?
Well, I think there's two problems going in. One is kind of a contextual atmospheric, which is the gender dynamic that's at play here. And there is definitely a potential for a male candidate to come off as condescending, overly aggressive to a female candidate. It's unfair. It's kind of silly that that's the way it is, because women should be treated like any other candidate and with the same respect. But that's the way, you know, the perception game is. And, you know, I think you saw it with Hillary Clinton in the Rick Lazio debate, where there's this famous incident where he, you know, was very aggressive in a debate towards her, and it really kind of backfired on him. And I think that's a sensitivity that Joe Biden has to have, it, particularly given the way that some Democrats, and I have some, a small minority, were kind of nasty in attacking Sarah Palin personally, which made her a much more sympathetic and likable figure in the broader electorate.
But he can't come across as too courtly or too gentlemanly, because then he'll also look sexist.
That's right. And that's part of the challenge, is that he has to walk a fine line. He has to be substantive and respectful, but at the same time, treat her like any other candidate. But to go back to your question, I think that the second issue for him is Joe Biden is a very smart, likable guy, and he has a great command of foreign policy, of domestic policy as well, and he is very honest, straightforward, and blunt, which are characteristics that I think many voters find appealing and refreshing in him. The danger with him, though, is sometimes he is loose-lipped and he's undisciplined with what he says. He goes on too long. He says things that are a little impolitic. Sometimes he even exaggerates. And, you know, that's the thing he has to be mindful of, irrespective of Sarah Palin, is being disciplined in what he says, keeping his answers tight and staying on message.
Well, how does he avoid coming across as a paternalistic know-it-all? Because in a way, he is a know-it-all. He does know a lot more than she does in terms of foreign policy. He's been around a lot longer. So how does he come across not being Joe Biden?
Well, I think there's two things. I wrote a column today about a way that I think actually Joe Biden could win the debate in the first 2 minutes, which would be up front, before any, you know, engaging in any of the debate, to come out and acknowledge that Sarah Palin has been treated unfairly by some people, including some Democrats, that the attacks on her family, questioning her mothering skills, all that personal stuff was out of bounds, was inappropriate and wrong. And they even go so far as to apologize to her for the behavior of some Democrats, and then to say, you know what, this is a candidacy that should be celebrated. This is a great step forward for women in politics. And I think the best way to honor that ideal is to treat Sarah Palin with the same respect and hold her to the same standard as any other candidate, and that's what he's going to try and do in this debate. I think that would set a very positive tone for the rest of the debate. And then secondly, I think what Joe Biden has to do in essence is not ignore Sarah Palin, because I think that would be condescending and patronizing as well, but really to kind of just say what he needs to say about why the Obama-Biden ticket is better for America than the McCain-Palin ticket, and not make it personal.
Dan Gerstein is a political communications consultant. Thank you very much.
Sure.
the latest financial troubles have meant more bad news for American cities. Some of them were already facing severe budget shortfalls, and now with credit getting tighter, it is getting harder to finance big city projects. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa is on the line now. Welcome to the program, Mayor.
Well, thank you for having me on. I thought you were going to introduce me as a Bolivian rapper.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you do wear several different hats that I'm not aware of. But let's talk about the financial crisis. Last week, you denounced the $700 billion bailout plan in Congress. And this week, though, you implored Congress to pass it, or a version of it at least. Why the change?
Well, we denounced the initial proposal by Secretary Paulson and the Bush administration to give one man the power to disperse $700 billion in a bailout package was neither reviewable by the Congress or appealable to the highest courts. That's different from the subsequent package that was hammered out. What we've said is, look, Congress needs to get back to the drawing board and hammer out a package. This isn't a time for partisan bickering. None of us are happy about the federal government having to devote hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out failed out lenders and investors. But the consequences of doing nothing to fix it is intolerable. And as city leaders, we have an opportunity and obligation to demonstrate strong fiscal management to ensure the financial health of the city, and we expect the Congress to do the same.
So you like the second package, or at least maybe the third package that the Senate is taking up tonight?
I think this third package is an improvement, yes. And I think most of the people that live in cities across the country are looking for leadership and bipartisanship right now.
Well, nearly half of the California delegation voted against it, and many liberal Democrats and many Democrats that are representing Hispanic and Black districts who say it's not good for our constituents. So how do you turn to your constituents, a majority of them who are minorities, and turn to them and say, yeah, this is good for you?
What I'm saying is very clearly that this is a crisis. A meltdown in the financial markets and a meltdown in the Congress as well. What we're saying is very clearly that we can't afford not to do anything, that we've got to continue to reach across the aisle to come up with a resolution here. We can't just sit there and not do anything. And from our vantage point, if AIG had gone down, they hold most of the municipal paper, the loans, for cities all across the country, including the city of Los Angeles. The impact on our pension funds, the impact on revenues with a continued crisis is great. And our point, my point specifically, was let's get back to work and get beyond the partisanship. What I mean by that is that we got to get something done and done as quickly as possible, something that addresses the needs of Main Street, as some of the folks who oppose this measure, but also that makes sure that we have enough liquidity in the markets that we don't have an even greater meltdown.
Are you already seeing the effects of the credit crunch and of the problems in raising debt to finance big projects and having to pay higher interest rates now?
Well, what we've seen is that credit's been drying up for some time now. We have some very big projects slated here in the city of Los Angeles that are great, that pencil out, but we've just been unable. The developers involved and very reputable, the nationally recognized developers have been unable to get the construction loans they need, the financing that would have otherwise been available.
Big projects like schools, like office buildings, things like that?
Well, big projects primarily like schools would come from, other bonds that have been approved already. But no, big projects like use projects, commercial housing, downtown, condo developments, hotels, yes.
So the whole revitalization of downtown is what you're talking about?
Not the whole revitalization of downtown. We're on track to revitalize. But yes, there have been some projects that have been impacted, as I said, by tightening in the credit market and the like.
Okay. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, madam.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Hedge funds, those exclusive pools of capital that have made many of the rich even richer, they too are suffering in this financial crisis. September 30th, that's yesterday, is one of several days of the year when investors can cash out of their hedge funds, as Madeline covered in her interview with Tom Wolf on the show yesterday. So, what happened? Marketplace's Janet Babin is here. Janet, what is so special about yesterday for these hedge fund investors?
Well, Alex, yesterday was the last day of the third quarter, and a lot of hedge funds have 90-day terms if you want to get your capital out. So hedge funds needed to be notified by their partners or clients 90 days in advance if they want to get their money out. And yesterday would have been the day to do that, to get it out by the end of the year, that 90-day limit. And with hedge funds down about 10% this year, according to hedge fund research, there's a lot of speculation out there that people in institutions probably yanked their money out yesterday.
Well, when do we get to see the numbers? When do we find out how many people did decide to pull out?
Yeah, we probably won't know that until the end of the year. I spoke to John Pinto about why that is. He's a managing partner of Brightleaf Capital Management. That's a hedge fund in North Carolina. And it manages under $100 million in assets. And like a lot of hedge funds, it's got both high net worth and institutional investors. And Pinto explained to me that a lot of clients are limited partners. They're all limited partners in hedge funds. They may have put in their redemption letters, and that's what it's called when you want to take your money out of a hedge fund. It's a redemption. But then there's usually a pushback from those letters from the hedge fund managers.
Limited partners will put in a redemption letter, and then the hedge fund will call them and try to talk them out of it. But essentially, it's an option that the limited partner has on deciding whether they do or don't want to take out their money.
So it's unclear just how many of those who may have asked for their money out yesterday will actually end up taking it out in 3 months. Those managers, of course, will try to convince the partners or clients to keep their money where it is.
Well, what do they do to limit how many investors take money out of the fund?
Well, one company, according to hedge fund research, this company RAB Capital, ended up getting a vote from its partners that will allow it to freeze redemptions for 3 years. Now, that fund saw its value drop by half, so if it didn't get that, if it wasn't able to do that, it could have been liquidated.
Are hedge fund investors, Janet, do you think worse off or better off than other people with money in the market?
Well, I think they're in a special situation, Alex. Hedge funds' goals have to make money no matter what's going on in the market. And to do that, they employ a lot of crazy strategies, one of them short selling that everyone's been hearing so much about, betting a company or stock will fail. And now that the Securities and Exchange Commission has limited or banned short selling on more than 900 companies, that's got to be tough for hedge fund managers to make money in this situation.
Thank you, Janet. Janet Babin of Public Radio's Daily Business Show, Marketplace.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Already this hurricane season, Fay, Gustav, Hannah, and Ike have passed over Haiti, killing about 700, destroying thousands of homes, plus livestock and crops. Haiti always needs help. Now it needs more. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez has offered additional food and emergency aid. It's not much compared to the aid that Haiti gets from the United States, but it does demonstrate the Venezuelans' efforts to gain more influence in the region. Reporter Roxandra Guidi has that story.
A couple dozen people are hauling food shipments out of a truck in front of the Venezuelan embassy. They're Haitians, Cubans, and Venezuelans, all volunteering their time to take in 34 tons of canned food, blankets, medicines, and water, which will then be distributed to people who've been affected by the hurricanes. The current Venezuelan humanitarian aid to Haiti is only $2 million, but it follows more significant investments planned in energy, health, and infrastructure. Venezuela's government contribution will total $1 billion. Pedro Luis Canino González is Venezuela's ambassador in Haiti. He says that Chavez's government is also providing cheap oil, and it's building an oil refinery and 3 electricity generating plants.
This is thanks to all the revolutionary changes that are happening in Venezuela, because only a true revolutionary government is capable of sharing its oil and its solidarity with Haiti in so many areas.
In contrast, the United States is contributing nearly 5 times as much as Venezuela in food aid. And U.S. foreign assistance to Haiti this year is almost $280 million. Much of the American emergency assistance is being distributed by the USS Kearsarge, a Navy ship that's docked right off of Haiti's western coast. Commodore Fernandez Ponce wouldn't address the issue of increased Venezuelan aid, but he did say that it's in the interest of the U.S. to continue its involvement in Latin America.
It's exactly about the renewed commitment, but it's a dedicated commitment. I mean, in a time of limited resources, you have to have somebody that's dedicated to look into this region continuously. So I don't know about the political aspect of it. All I know is we are here to fill a need because we have partners, we have friends, we have neighbors, and there's a need, and we're here to meet that need.
But in the streets of Port-au-Prince, Chavez is popular, especially among the poor. In March of last year, he visited the city and drew thousands of people who chanted, "Up with Chavez, down with Bush." Louis Bellefleur is a tap-tap, or public bus driver. He was among the people who gathered downtown last year to hear the Venezuelan president.
Chavez is a truly patriotic man. If only our Haitian leaders had more thoughts like him, Haiti wouldn't need as much international aid and it would start making more progress.
But Bellefleur remains a bit skeptical. He criticizes Chavez for using Haiti to draw attention to himself. And he says his long-term commitment to the Caribbean country still remains to be seen. For NPR News, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
In Bolivia, there's been a lot of political turmoil recently. Last month, nearly 24 people were killed in unrest. Here's one silver lining. Musicians are producing protest music from all of this, including hard-driving political rap. NPR's Juan Ferreira reports.
Indigenous music from the highlands, capturing the hard lives of its people. But Bolivian music also comes from the far eastern lowlands. Guitar-laden cruceño, music made for dancing. In the south, there's Enriqueta Ulloa and her folkloric songs. Now, a new kind of music has spread like fire across the gritty cinderblock city of El Alto, 14,000 feet up in the highlands, home to hundreds of thousands of Aymara Indians. The music is rap, and it's hard and fast. Here, railing against consumerism and money, and promising to break the chains of oppression and spark revolution. The music is, in some cases, sung in Aymara, the predominant tongue among highland Indians in this region of Bolivia. The lyrics stem from Bolivia's tradition of protest music, condemning the Yankees while celebrating the newfound power and influence that has buoyed indigenous people here since Evo Morales, an Aymara Indian, won the presidency in 2005. The song is in Aymara, called We're Going to Rise Up. The songwriter is Abraham Borges.
Dice al principio, ahora siempre levantaremos a nuestro pueblo. Nosotros siempre tenemos que levantar, dice, ¿no?
Borges explains that the song tells the story of Bolivia's native people, children of the great warrior Tupac Atari and the Aymara's long struggle.
Yo creo que...
He says his music tries to speak for the people, to denounce injustice, or to honor indigenous communities for what he calls the recuperation of indigenous identity. Álvaro Montenegro, who teaches at the National Conservatory of Music, also produces rap music at his home studio. Like this song, The Abyss of Racism, by Borges. It says racism is here, there, everywhere. When will it stop? Montenegro says it's a theme familiar to many Bolivians, among the hard social themes that spawned and continues to inspire Bolivian rap.
The youth of El Alto was looking for a particular personal expression in order to find a vehicle, an artistic vehicle, to put forward their own ideas, their own ways of thinking, their own ways of challenging society.
Montenegro says young alteños, as they're called, began rapping in 2003 when Bolivian troops shot several dozen demonstrators. It was an event that helped propel Evo Morales to power. As Bolivia's first indigenous president, Morales has promised to overturn the old social order. That gave rappers even more to sing about.
Since Bolivia was in the political eye of the world, and these young musicians, some of them became pretty famous, you know, have had tours already in many countries in South America and have received a lot of attention.
Many of the rappers fine-tuned their work in a radio station in El Alto, Huayna Tambo. Under bare light bulbs, squeezed into a small room, Borges and his fellow musicians practice. The next day, they're off for a concert in Ecuador. Freddy Limanchi runs the tracks, the heavy beat at the base of rap music.
Buscar pues una identidad propia, conocer lo que es Bolivia, entonces hacer una música, por ejemplo, de escuchar la fusión en banda, trompeta.
He says there's clearly American hip-hop in the music, but there's also a fusion with trumpets, bongos, and windpipes. That gives it a Bolivian twist. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, El Alto, Bolivia.
Back now with Day to Day and a few moments with our listeners and with the readers of our blog, Daydreaming. Senior producer Steve Prophet is here to help share some of what we've been hearing from you. Steve?
Hi, Madeline. Yesterday, you posted a simple query on the blog. The headline was, okay, now, bailout, yes or no?
Then after the measure went down in the House and the market dropped dramatically on Monday, we wanted to know if that might have changed your thinking. Maybe you changed your mind. Maybe you had a better idea.
Again, we got a lot of responses, and you can read the many comments at our blog, npr.org/daydreaming. Here's one of them.
My name is Teresa from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. My husband and I own a small restaurant, and we believe that the bailout is very, very necessary. When consumers are afraid they stop eating out, they stop patronizing other small businesses, our small economy stops. If we can't pay our rents, then landlords can't pay their mortgages, and we all start to fall like dominoes.
That's Teresa Browngold. She went on to say that she hates the idea of a Wall Street bailout, but she believes it will help people like her on Main Street.
Steve, that Wall Street-Main Street comparison really bugs listener Mark Roth. He wrote to us from Binghamton, New York. He says, Main Street already went bust. Remember the big box stores and suburban sprawl?
And he has these suggestions for alternate language. How about Wall Street and Your Street?
Or a little more panache, Wall Street and Mall Street.
Now, Madeline, here's another view.
My name is Don Gillum. I'm calling from Bartlesville, Oklahoma. I guess I would be seen by most big city people as a bubba. I live in a 10-year-old double-wide trailer in the country because that's what I can afford. I've watched people with less income than me live in mansions, drive new cars, own every kind of toy you can imagine, all paid for on credit cards and third mortgages. Now, for years, I've been waiting for their bubble to bust, for the irresponsible borrowers and the irresponsible lenders to have to clean up their mess. But wait, maybe I should have to help bail them out. I'd rather go through a depression than let the government take over everything. I mean, wouldn't that be like communism? I thought freedom wasn't free. Let the guilty pay. Leave me alone.
Don Gillum of Bartlesville, Oklahoma.
Overall, most of you who wrote in still seem to be against the bailout. And many of you said, give the money to the people, help folks refinance their mortgages, whatever. Just don't give it to the people who created this problem.
Still, Madeline, it seems like small business owners out there are really starting to feel the pinch.
My name is Tracy Dunno. I'm from Lafayette, Indiana. My husband and I have our own business and have no lack of customers and work. But due to the current economic situation, our local bank has put the brakes on lending to us after we refurbished an empty factory to grow the business. We have 30 to 40 people with families depending on us, so not having access to credit is a pretty big deal for us. Americans are tired of being given half the story and then told the issue is too complex for us to understand. Maybe if someone, anyone, with no partisan viewpoint could give us the straight story, we could understand.
That's Tracy Deno. She owns a small business in Lafayette, Indiana. Finally, this from listener Ahmad Kabili. He notes that after the $700 billion bailout package failed in the House, the Dow dropped 777 points.
Which is about 7%.
Mr. Kabili thinks 7 is just not a lucky number for this proposal.
And he suggests proposing a $698 billion bailout as the next move. Thanks to all who wrote us. Join the fray at our blog, Daydreaming.
It's npr.org/daydreaming.
And it's turning into quite a lively little spot for conversation.
Steve Proffitt, thank you.
You're welcome, Madeline.
One more item before the vice presidential debate tomorrow night, this one about identity. At the Republican convention, Alaska Governor, now vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin famously tossed off this quip.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
So the audience loved it, but it's not so good for fellow hockey mom Polly Ingram.
Much has been made about Sarah Palin and pig lipstick. I'm not getting in that sty. But I am a hockey mom, and I have a score to settle after her quip. Speaking on behalf of many of my sisters in the stands, and even the much-maligned pit bulls, I gotta wonder, what rink is she on? If you've watched a few professional hockey games, it might seem like a violent sport for young players. But it's not. My 14-year-old daughter plays in a non-checking girls' league. That means they can't bang each other against the boards. And, for the most part, parents are civil. We know how to deal with overzealous parents, too. Occasionally, when an adult is out of line, the rest of us exert pressure. Few can stand up to the withering group glare. We are much more apt to compliment each other's kids when they have modest successes, say a perfect pass or a hard shot on goal, than we are to pound on the refs. If it's really cold in the rink, parents with blankets are happy to share them. There is a fellowship born of common experiences. We all know what it's like to get up way too early, to drive our skaters, who are usually silent, to faraway locations where we will find unappetizing food and cold bathrooms. Our cars all have the same post-game smell. We're from different socioeconomic classes. We're liberals and conservatives. Some of us wear lipstick, and most of us do not. But we pretty much all agree that we're not in the arena to be nasty. Which leads to the other reason why the joke was offensive. My brother works as an adoption counselor at an animal shelter, where he sees more pit bulls than any other breed. Can they go for the jugular? Yes, if they are trained to. We all remember the Michael Vick horror. But these dogs are often completely loving and eager for affection. This stereotype, too, just doesn't hold up in real life. As the hockey season gets underway again, I'm hopeful that come November, the huddled masses of hockey moms and dads will rise up and vote to help our country move forward. And in the meantime, I'm ordering the bumper sticker that says, "More hockey, less war."
Writer and hockey mom Polly Ingram lives in Amherst, Massachusetts. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.